their jobs in droves, as some feared. Instead, they're using this financial cushion to examine their lives and reimagine what is possible. One single mother finally had the breathing room to start her own business. Another recipient struggling with burnout reduced his workload to prioritize his mental health. These stories, echoed by hundreds more, challenge the misconception that guaranteed income makes people lazy. Instead, it empowers them to pursue their passions and contribute more fully to society. The largest UBI experiment to date is providing payments to 20,000 people for 12 years. Pilot programs in the US, Canada, and Finland show that UBI can improve health, education, as well as increase trust in governments. As trials expand, UBI offers the potential to reshape our approach to social welfare, providing a safety net that promotes well-being and enables individuals and communities to thrive. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
Dan worries what a Trump told no will do next. KBOO's news poet Dan Raphael has more.
Trump caved on releasing the Epstein files. The indictments Trump commanded on Comey and James got thrown out of court. Appeals for sure. He was jovial with Mondani, who still says Trump is a fascist. No one cares about drug boats being murdered. Marjorie Taylor Greene is bailing out. Senator Captain Astronaut Mark Kelly could be court-martialed for reminding soldiers they should not obey illegal orders. Donnie can't stand being told no. He'll lash out. Imagining what Trump will do to get back our attention and the devotion of the MAGA folks frightens me. As we're maybe at the stage of numbness from repeated outrages and claims, it'll require getting someone else so mad they kill or injure some Americans, and we'll need to, like our dear ally Israel, retaliate 100 or 1,000-fold. Maybe Santa will give a few Senate and congressional Republicans some heart, brains, and courage, things some Supreme Court justices could also use. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 26, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Jezaniah Hawthorne. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mandy Stapleford, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Dr. Anthony Lizawith, Pearl Stark, Rick Smith, and Judith Ruiz Branch. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Danny Shy.
And I'm Anna Wilcox. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
Thanksgiving. Columbus Day, Veterans Day. What happens when the stories behind our holidays don't tell the whole truth? On this edition of Peace Talks Radio, we hear from people working to rename and reclaim these commemorations and why it matters for peace and justice.
Students, often middle school or high school students, who come in and testify and say, I read about this, I learned about this, why are we celebrating Columbus? Like, they're angry.
Columbus Day has been replaced in many communities, but it's not the only holiday people are reframing.
Veterans Day is clearly a recruitment tool, and it asks us not to think critically about what soldiers are actually doing around the world, but just celebrating the idea that they are, quote-unquote, serving in the military.
Reframing Holidays, today on Peace Talks Radio. This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Whether it's the search for inner peace, harmony in our closest relationships, or understanding in our workplaces, schools, neighborhoods, and beyond, we explore it here on Peace Talks Radio. From personal moments to global movements, we consider what it takes to build a more peaceful world. I'm Jessica Tichton, today with correspondent Andrew Stelzer. Our days off from school and work are precious, and many of us are so caught up in our daily lives that we don't always stop to consider why we've marked that special date on the calendar. But what we choose to collectively honor and why shape our national and cultural identities. When there are false narratives behind those holidays, it can be hurtful and harmful. Those stories might be covering up painful truths. The holiday names can be used to promote the political agendas of those in power. For this episode, we hear from people working to rename and reclaim several holidays: Thanksgiving, Columbus Day, and Veterans Day. In part two of this episode, we'll talk to Rory Fanning, a former U.S. Army Ranger turned war resister. He's part of a campaign to give Veterans Day back to its pre-1954 name, Armistice Day. But first, in part one, we'll hear about a gathering and ceremony held in Plymouth, Massachusetts, each fourth Thursday of November, the day more popularly known as Thanksgiving. In 1970, the United American Indians of New England declared Thanksgiving Day to be a national day of mourning for Native Americans. Over the years, the day has included protest marches, passionate speeches, arrests, and more, all in an effort to educate the greater public about the true story of how indigenous people of the region interacted with the so-called pilgrims, and the painful legacy of that relationship. Here's Andrew Stelzer interviewing Matoe Monroe, the co-leader of the United American Indians of New England.
It's important to get one thing clear right from the start. As Matoe Monroe explained to me, the National Day of Mourning isn't the same as the more well-known campaign to rename Columbus Day.
We don't go to towns and ask them to pass resolutions to get rid of Thanksgiving as a holiday. We're not demanding everybody call it National Day of Mourning. We're not, but we feel that it's important to get rid of that false mythology.
Monroe has been helping organize the National Day of Mourning since the 1990s, and she first attended back in the 80s. She says the myth of peaceful pilgrims and Indians sitting down together to a celebratory feast won't just fade away. It has to be replaced with the truth.
The story doesn't start with the pilgrims. There's more than 12,000 years of Wampanoag history prior to the arrival of the pilgrims.
It's a history Monroe herself has continued to learn and teach over time. When you were growing up, what was your family and community doing and feeling on the fourth Thursday of November? What was that time like? What did that mean?
Well, for my family, everyone appreciated the Thanksgiving aspect of Thanksgiving. That is the idea of giving thanks, because as Native people, we give thanks every day. That's an important part of our lives and of our spiritual practices. There was certainly an idea, though, that the way that the Thanksgiving myth was presented was really problematic for us. I don't think my family knew the exact history at that time, but we did, even as kids, understand that Native people didn't live happily ever after. The whole problem is that the Thanksgiving myth is dishonest, and it does make it seem as though the pilgrims, who, by the way, weren't even called pilgrims, landed on Plymouth Rock, which they didn't do. They landed first in Provincetown, by the way. And the rest of the myth is that the Native people welcomed those pilgrims with open arms and shared a harvest feast. And then we somehow, as the Native people, somehow faded into the background. And that's the end of it. It's like we disappeared into the forest or something. And even a long time ago, when I was a kid, we felt uncomfortable with that myth, because we knew that things could not possibly have been going that well, because we were well aware of how settlers have behaved with indigenous peoples for a very long time. And we also knew that we hadn't just faded into the background, that obviously there had to still be Native people around.
And then how, over the years, did your understanding of Thanksgiving and that time of the year change? And how did your feelings change? What was the evolution?
Well, at a certain point, I started to hear about National Day of Mourning in the sense that it was a day of pride and truth-telling and activism and prayer that was led by Native people in Plymouth who came in from all over to be there at the very first National Day of Mourning in 1970, but to continue it over the years. And I started to learn more about what actually had happened very specifically in Massachusetts, in the Plymouth Plantation, in the various colonies that the English set up within the New England region. And I personally started fasting on Thanksgiving at that time. It wasn't, though, until the 1980s that I started attending National Day of Mourning. And the traditional thing that we did at National Day of Mourning, as it turned out, was to fast during the day. We would start to fast the night before so-called Thanksgiving, and then would fast during the day. And after the speak out was done, we would go and have a social afterwards. I think a lot of people think it's just another protest or just another demonstration, but we're in ceremony all day. We start the ceremony the day before, in fact, with the fasting. So it has significance on a lot of levels.
I'm speaking with Matowi Monroe, the co-leader of the United American Indians of New England. When you got involved in the 1980s, how did you learn about the history of the particular events in Plymouth that had began in 1970? And tell us a little bit about the history of the event.
The first time I went to National Day of Mourning, I went with some people who had been going for years and who had told me about it. And I was really excited to go. And I met Wamsutta Frank James, who was a founder of National Day of Mourning, and got to know him very well over the years. But he had a lot of details about the history that certainly had not been discussed or acknowledged at that point. The 1960s, going into the 1970s, there was a time of what was called the Red Power Movement. And American Indian Movement and many other organizations were protesting police brutality in Native communities. There was an organization here in New England called the Federated Eastern Indian League, which would become later United American Indians of New England, our organization. We came from that organization. There were many organizations and individuals who were being insistent that Indigenous people should no longer be ignored. In some places, such as Massachusetts, it was happening in a state that basically acted as though Native people were all extinct, which was crazy. Wamsutta Frank James said that he and his siblings grew up being told in school that there were no Indians left anymore, even though there they were, then they certainly knew that they were a Quinawampanoag. So there were all these things happening. And I would say a big spark was in November of 1969, there were about 200 Native people who seized the old penitentiary on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco. And for 19 months, Native people occupied the island to draw attention to the conditions on Indian reservations. And ever since then, they have had un-Thanksgiving Day out at Alcatraz. Here in so-called New England, Wamsutta Frank James was invited by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to speak at a banquet in 1970, which was to celebrate the 350th anniversary of the arrival of the Pilgrims. The organizers of the banquet thought that he was going to come in and give an appreciative and complimentary speech saying, oh, thank you so much for coming here. We're such good friends, Pilgrims and Native people together, do that kind of thing about how wonderful it was that the Pilgrims had come. And I think they thought that he was literally going to thank the Pilgrims for bringing civilization to Wampanoag people. However, the speech that he wrote was not exactly complimentary at all. The state asked for an advance copy of his speech. And when they saw it, they freaked out and told him that he could not deliver it, that that was not okay, that he would have to change it. This is because Wamsutta's speech not only named some of the atrocities by the settlers and reflected upon the treatment of the Wampanoag at the hand of the Pilgrims, but also contained a powerful message of Native pride. So the state said the speech was too inflammatory, and they said that he could speak only if he were willing to praise the Pilgrims. The organizers even offered to write a speech for him, to put words in his mouth. And this is something that they wanted him to do that would fit in better with their settler colonial narrative. But Wamsutta was a person of integrity and refused to have those words put into his mouth. His so-called suppressed speech of 1970 was then printed in newspapers across the country, and he and other local Native activists began to plan a protest. The flyer for that first protest in 1970 was circulated among Native people, so people around the country heard about this. And the flyer said, "What do we have to be thankful for? The United American Indians of New England has declared Thanksgiving Day to be a national day of mourning for Native Americans." And so it was a shot that was fired into this, what settler colonialism considers to be this holy, sacred holiday of Thanksgiving that is nothing but lies about how Native people were treated and what happened to Native people after the invasion of Europeans.
And so what happened from there? How did the day evolve, and how did that name, National Day of Mourning, continue to spread?
Sure. So on so-called Thanksgiving Day 1970, Wamsutta and members of at least 25 tribes, not just tribes from this region, but people who came in from other places, as well as non-Native allies, came here to what's called Coles Hill, which is a hill in Plymouth, which overlooks the harbor and is right above where the Plymouth Rock Monument is. And that was the first National Day of Mourning. That first year, Wamsutta didn't get a chance to deliver his suppressed speech, because there was a lot going on. There were up to 200 Native people and allies gathered on that day. They spoke out about the Pilgrim invasion and about the conditions in Indian country to set the record straight about how Native people were actually living. They marched around Plymouth. There's a replica of the Mayflower at the Plymouth waterfront. They boarded the Mayflower too, and they threw the English flag overboard. And they even buried Plymouth Rock. Burying Plymouth Rock was something that we did multiple years, but it started the first year.
What does that mean, you buried it?
Well, Plymouth Rock is not this giant Rock of Gibraltar kind of thing. Plymouth Rock is maybe as big as a dresser drawer, you know. It's not that big. It's not where they landed. And they dragged this rock from the middle of town, and it broke, and they dragged it down and put this kind of cage around it and then built this whole proscenium arch thing over on top of it. So it's always interesting to us when we march in Plymouth every year to see the tourists kind of standing around looking at the rock, looking disappointed, which is an appropriate response to it. But also, we often will speak to the tourists too. And we're like, "Hello, tourists. This is maybe not what you were expecting today, but we're here to tell you the truth about Thanksgiving and what really happened here."
You've been listening to Reframing the Holidays Toward Justice and Peace with Jessica Tickton and Andra Stelzer on Peace Talks Radio. You can hear the rest of this programming at nv1.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Frank.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Trump's pick for ambassador to South Africa has vowed to put pressure on the government in Pretoria to end proceedings against Israel before the International Court of Justice and to pressure the International Criminal Court prosecutor to discontinue the case. And when he spoke before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at his recent nomination hearing, L. Brent Bozell III refused to express his opinion on whether the U.S. should reimpose voting limits on black citizens. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Michael Brown, an associate editor with the Electronic Intifada, about the Bozell nomination.
Who is this guy, Bozell? What can you say about him, and what kind of history does he have?
Bozell is a long-standing right-wing media activist. He does not have a diplomatic background. He's, for years, targeted what he's seen as left-wing bias in mainstream media. And then when he came for his nomination hearing, then the senators, particularly Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, unpacked a lot of the baggage that he brought with him. Yes, very, you know, a very simple question, whether Bozell would support bringing back laws in this country to only allow white people to vote. And I think was flummoxed and astonished that on such a simple question, Bozell was not willing to give a straightforward answer, his own personal opinion. As Murphy said, it should have been a layup. And so that really, for me, began to, when I saw that clip, began to set off alarm bells. And then as I dug into it more, I also saw the relationship, not just with civil rights issues in this country, but Bozell's positions over the years on apartheid South Africa, and then on Gaza and the genocide there, and what he intended to do to pressure South Africa with the International Criminal Court.
And what did he say about South Africa? I believe you mentioned something about his attitude toward the ANC.
That's right. Bozell wrote a letter in 1987. So we're going back nearly 40 years, but it I think is indicative of where he's coming from. At that point, he was the president of an outfit called the National Conservative Political Action Committee. And he was writing to the Conservative Caucus and said that his organization is, quote, proud to become a member of the Coalition Against ANC Terrorism. So it's important to remember that at this time, and actually for years, the U.S. regarded the ANC as not a freedom organization, but as a terrorist organization. And for me, doing Palestine-related work, it's very reminiscent of what Palestinians face, where the U.S. was not supportive of first nonviolent efforts. It wasn't particularly on board with diplomatic efforts in South Africa. And then it certainly wasn't supportive of any indications of violence by the ANC. And that's almost precisely mirrored by what we see with U.S. policy today, with nonviolent activity by the Palestinians is negatively sanctioned. Diplomatic activity is negatively sanctioned. And of course, any violent resistance is negatively sanctioned. So really the policy both carrying forward from South Africa and to the Palestinians is, we don't want you to take any action. We want you to sit on your hands like good little boys and girls and not rock the boat, not call for your freedom, not call for equal rights. And South Africa, or Israel in its case, will be determined when and how, or if ever, some semblance of freedom will be granted. So that sort of links in all the many issues that I have with where Bozell is coming from. And he made very clear in the hearing that he would take up the fight against South Africa. South Africa took its case of genocide to the International Court of Justice a couple of years ago. And he made clear to Senator Lee of Utah that he would be contesting that in his position as ambassador to South Africa. He in fact said in the nomination hearing, what South Africa did in leading the charge against Israel in the International Court of Justice was an injustice. And Lee was right on board with that. And unfortunately, as is so often the case, many of the Democrats simply asked him important questions, Murphy in particular, about civil rights issues, voting rights, the franchise for black voters in this country. But they're still very reluctant, despite the enormous grassroots support for the rights of Palestinians, they're still reluctant to take him on his positions on Israel and the genocide that's been carried out over the last 2 years.
So what's going to happen if he is confirmed and he goes to meet with, say, Cyril Ramaphosa or the other South African leaders? That's not likely to go well, right?
I think you're right that, you know, there's rightfully an enormous amount of pride among South African leaders in what they were able to accomplish in overthrowing apartheid. And it's really a sort of in-your-face move by Trump to to put somebody out there who has this history of opposing the anti-apartheid movement. One of the questions in my mind is whether they will accept him or throw Bozell out in the same way that Marco Rubio several months ago threw out Ibrahim Rasool, the South African ambassador to the U.S. The difference, of course, being that the U.S. is an economic powerhouse, and so it will be challenging for South Africa to risk greater wrath from Trump, tariffs, economic limitations on aid. It would take a tremendous amount of courage to do so, but I think both from the South African leadership and the people, they may see it as a bridge too far and say, we're not going to accept this man as the ambassador. But as I say, it would take real courage to do that, and it would probably come with consequences.
So do you see the nomination of Bozell as something that kind of goes along with Trump's idea that whites in South Africa are being oppressed and they need asylum in the U.S., or they can have it if they want it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's this absurd policy now that they're moving towards. I refer to it as a hypothetical when Murphy asked about all refugees now only being white, but it's in fact very close to that. Trump wants to accept 7,500 refugees into the U.S., and 7,000 of them would be white Afrikaners. So it does go along with Trump's policy there. I think he would be supportive of it. And this absurd notion of a white genocide being carried out in South Africa. And of course, you've got on the one hand this notion of white genocide, which none of the experts on genocide are saying is taking place in South Africa. And on the other hand, you've got Trump denying that an actual genocide is taking place in Gaza, and you have Bozell putting out atrocity propaganda like the 40 beheaded babies, which, as appalling as it is to think about, that did not take place. The Biden administration had to walk it back. CNN walked it back. Sarah Sidner apologized for her statement on that. And so Bozell had actually put out literature to his supporters with his media research center saying that had happened, and he's never walked it back and apologized. So I think it goes very much along with the Trump policy of trying to fixate our gaze on things that are not actually happening, and trying to use his rhetoric to suggest, on the one hand, that there is a genocide, a white genocide in Gaza, as he calls, or in South Africa, as he calls it, and that there's not one in Gaza. And it's very clear to me from what Bozell has said that he'll be in firm agreement with Trump on where he's coming from on these issues. He's too terrified even to express a very simple position on voting rights in the U.S., and so I expect that he'll support all of Trump's policies in trying to pressure on the ICJ and the ICC. He said as much in the nomination hearing.
So when the vote does take place, would you expect pretty much a straight party line vote, or are some Republicans defecting or starting to defect?
I would be shocked if the Republicans defect. We haven't seen that very much at all in the Trump years. I think that there will be Democrats that will vote against, much in the same way that they voted against David Friedman when he was being put forward to be ambassador to Israel. It's a 52-46 vote. And so I expect it to be on largely along party line. I don't know what, say, somebody like Fetterman is going to do on it, but I think that it will go forward. Something astonishing would have to come out, even more astonishing than what we've seen. I just don't think the Republicans are at a point where they're going to be willing to say this is not going to go over well with South Africa's government or the people. And they're content to send a message, because oftentimes the cruelty seems to be the point.
And anything else you want to add to what you've said?
I think that there are a whole number of issues that we could get into with even the mainstream media and how this has not been a story. Yes, there's a lot on their plate, but it's the sort of thing that I think in years past might have been picked up on. And the astonishing pace at which Trump comes at the American public with one abuse after another, it means that in important stories like this, what should be an important story, there's simply not space, and they're not making the space for it as of yet. Perhaps they'll do it when the vote comes up, but they certainly didn't do it during the nomination hearing. So I think that's one angle that we should be keeping an eye on, is pressuring mainstream media. This is why it's critical that the smaller outlets, the social media is on it, that they're paying attention, and these things are not slipping by in the way they might otherwise do. I think tangentially to it, there are aspects with the entire blow-up with Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson and the Heritage Foundation on where the political right is moving. But their notions of an ethno-state in the U.S., I think, are such that they're not going to rock the boat on this. In fact, they're very much in alliance with it.
Do you think the attention hasn't been paid to it because it's an ambassador job rather than, say, a Supreme Court justice? You know, if you think back to the hearings about Robert Bork or Clarence Thomas or even David Souter, do ambassador nominations usually get that much attention?
They don't get as much, certainly, as Bork or Souter or Thomas got in their time. I do remember a bit more with David Friedman when that was coming up. It seemed as though there was a fair amount of attention to it, but for some reason, Bozell has not generated the same outcry. I would have thought that, say, the Progressive Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus, would be pounding away on this. Even the DNC would be raising it, and I've not seen a lot of attention given over to it. And I think it's, as I say, it's part of the onslaught of stuff that is put out by the Trump administration, where, you know, there's so much attention one day on ceasefire, and then the next day it's Epstein, and the next day it's something else, and the smaller stories simply don't get the attention.